From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The United States goes on a sanctions spree against Turkey, Russia, and Iran. Is it working? Plus, Democrats think they've found a winning campaign theme by running against corruption in Washington. Are they right about that? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot from The Wall Street Journal. And to talk about these subjects, I'm here with my colleagues, as ever, Kim Strassel. Hello, Kim.
Hello, Paul.
And Dan Henninger.
Good to be with you.
All righty. Let's talk about the sanctions policy, because it's fascinating in a couple of ways to me. I mean, sanctions have been an eternal foreign policy tool, but only in recent years have we discovered that the clout of American financial sanctions, Dan, is really enormous, and there's a lot more leverage than I think we would have thought. I mean, going back to the 80s with sanctions against South Africa, they worked, but that was a global phenomenon. Now we're seeing that even U.S. sanctions have an impact. And of course, this week, we take these countries one at a time. On Friday, the sanctions against Turkey were really beginning to bite this week. And then Turkey sent an official to negotiate with the United States about the potential release of the pastor, Andrew Brunson, who's been arrested by Turkey and charged with aiding and abetting the coup on what I think everybody acknowledges is flimsy evidence. But that failed. Those talks failed. And Donald Trump on Friday morning escalated by saying he was going to double the tariffs on aluminum and steel, 50% on steel, against Turkish imports. And the lira fell 14% in a single day.
Yeah, and the Dow Jones and the stock market's down as well. Paul, there are a lot of pieces in motion here, for sure. You are right that it wasn't all that long ago that our idea would be that sanctions were not a particularly effective tool. Countries could always find ways around them. Times have changed over the last 25 years. We now live in a much more globalized world. It's interrelated. Most of the world's business is conducted in dollars. Most of the world's central banks are heavily invested in dollars, as is Turkey. 50% of Turkey's external debt is dollar denominated. The people conducting the sanctions in the U.S. Treasury Department, I have to say, have gotten very sophisticated about identifying targets in places like Iran, Russia, and Turkey. So we can impose sanctions now in a way that do hurt, and we're doing so for political reasons. The issue that's kind of emerging here is whether you should be carrying out a sanctions regime simultaneous with a trade war.
Right.
And there is also as well the question of the volatility of international currencies. The UK central bank recently raised interest rates significantly. The US central bank, the Fed, is not. So there's an interest rate divergence there, always an opportunity for traders. And the European Central Bank itself has to be quite sensitive to the conditions in Turkey, Italy, Spain, and Greece. They're monitoring Turkish lira bank holdings of the banks in all those countries. So what I'm saying here, Paul, is there is a lot in motion. And when you put big waves in motion in the world financial system, it does carry risks, and I think the U.S. Treasury Department and the White House have got to be sensitive to the risks that they're putting in motion.
Yeah, the sharp exchange rate movements putting enormous pressure on Recep Erdogan, the president of Turkey. But because of that dollar-denominated debt and who might hold that dollar-denominated Turkish debt, obviously – when the lira falls, repaying that dollar-denominated debt gets a lot more expensive because you have to repay the dollar debt in dollars. But if your income is earned in lira, your debt burden becomes that much more severe. And repaying that, if it goes down too much or stays down too long, can become a real economic problem. And then that can have ripple effects across the economy, Kim. But Donald Trump, we've watched him now for 18 months. He doesn't differentiate in his among tools between economic, military, diplomatic. They're all part of his arsenal, and he'll fire them to get his to get what he wants.
Well, yeah, I think that that's notable. We're talking here, we started out talking about sanctions, but of course he has used them interchangeably with these threats of raising tariffs, which was really what did hit the lira in the last day or so, which was it wasn't necessarily a sanctions. We did sanction two ministers in Turkey several weeks ago, the ministers of Justice and Interior, specifically over their detention of this American pastor and the failure to release him. But Trump has kind of put the two together, tariffs and sanctions, and that's what's really hitting Turkey's economy. And you see the same thing happening in Russia, where the ruble has also, since 2014, when Russia invaded the Crimea, the cumulative number of Western sanctions that have been imposed on it have caused the ruble to drop half of its value. And you saw a stock sell off today because we now have a new round of sanctions that are being imposed that were specifically, they're mandated under U.S. law as a response to Russia's involvement in the nerve agent attack on this former Russian spy, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter in London. And what's really rattled Moscow's markets is that these particular first round of sanctions deal with some U.S. exports to Russia that deal with dual technologies that might be used for military use, and there's a clampdown on those exports. But if the president doesn't certify in the next 3 months that Russia has ceased using nerve agents, won't use them in the future, and agrees to submit to inspections, all of which seem highly unlikely that Russia would do, then there's a second round that goes in that really are even tougher, that get to bank loans. You can oppose loans and assistance to Russia by international banks. You can bar U.S. banks from issuing loans or credit to the Russian government. And that is what's hitting the market. You've got stocks in Aeroflot and national state banks that are plummeting under the fear that this is an inevitable next step that's coming as well, too.
Well, and all of this is this volatility in currencies is accentuated by the recent strength this year in the U.S. dollar. After the tax reform, that's an incentive for a lot more people to invest in the United States. Capital flows are moving to the United States. Fed is increasing rates. Whether or not rapidly enough is a debate, but they're increasing. So what you see is dollar flows into the United States, and that puts pressure on currencies and in emerging markets in particular. Although I have to say, it's also putting pressure on the euro, Dan, the European, the euro currency, and our old friend Bob Mueller, or Robert Mundell, the economist, used to say that the most important price in the world is the euro dollar exchange rate, because so much of global trade and investment flows through those two currencies. When you get disruptions, sharp disruptions in currencies, you can create economic dislocations.
Yeah, that's right. And normally, traditionally anyway, if you were undertaking a set of initiatives, strategies, whatever you want to call this, offensives, it would be done in coordination with our partners, or if I dare say, our allies. But, you know, the Trump White House has kind of put some distance between itself and its traditional partners and allies. And there's no real evidence at the moment that all of these strategies are being done in a coordinated way. But I think what we are talking about, what's begun to happen in the last 48 hours, suggests that the Treasury Department probably does need to begin coordinating with our partners in Europe, at least on the currency, so that things don't flip too far out of sync in a way that the markets cannot read what's happening.
We're talking about Donald Trump and the world and Democratic campaign strategy for the midterms. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
The Future of Everything podcast from the Wall Street Journal. Another new episode is coming soon. From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kim Strassel and Dan Henninger. And just to finish up on the subject, Dan, following up on your point about the Treasury coordinating with allies, it's going to be hard to do that if, given the fact that there's this tension now between the U.S. and Europe over Iran sanctions. Donald Trump reimposing this week sanctions on Iran that were lifted when they signed the nuclear deal in 2015 with Iran. Trump has left that deal, reimposed sanctions. Governments are very unhappy about that because the sanctions basically issue an ultimatum to European companies that if they don't pull out of Iran, they won't be able to do business in the United States. And Donald Trump this week tweeted, companies that do business with Iran will not be doing business with the United States.
And I'll say quickly, I favor the Iranian initiative that they've undertaken. But at the moment, Donald Trump looks like one of the world's great jugglers. He's got about 10 balls up there in the air simultaneously. And man, if he can pull this off, it'll be quite an act.
Kim, just briefly on this, I don't see him stopping, do you?
No, I don't. I think he likes the fact that he gets him a response. And as you noted, Turkey is sending someone over to try to negotiate perhaps a release of this pastor. That is, in theory, what began all this. So if he gets that result, he will claim victory and he will believe that, you know, this is the path forward. And he doesn't make a distinction either often between people that or countries that truly are not allies of ours and our allies. And I mean, he does have a point, by the way, on the European companies. One problem with the sanctions regime in recent years has been that people cheat. And they get around it. And so the countries that are subject to it don't feel the pain. But I think Donald Trump, when he gets a victory, he takes it as a sign that that is a strategy that works, and he tends to double down.
And Turkey will be a real test of this, whether or not they can negotiate something to get Pastor Brunson out. All right, let's turn to domestic politics. And the emerging theme of the Democratic Party, Kim, one of the big themes this year is to run against corruption. Corruption in Washington. They were given a talking point on that theme this week with the indictment for insider trading of Chris Collins, who is a Republican from upstate New York, is alleged in the indictment from the Southern District of New York to have leaked word of the failure of a drug trial to his son, Cameron, who then traded to avoid losses in a drug stock. Gave that information to his father-in-law, who also traded and saved money. And, of course, that fits into the Paul Manafort trial and more broadly into the Democratic accusations that the entire Trump administration is corrupt. Does this theme have legs?
Well, not very strong legs. But, I mean, look, hey, give Democrats credit for landing on some campaign theme, which they have struggled to do, to find anything other than, you know, we oppose and resist President Trump.
Yeah, well, that's the main one.
That's the main one. They don't they can't really run much on the economic message because the economy is doing well. Republicans are talking about that. So they've landed on corruption. It is a perennial, not a perennial, but every couple of cycles you see this come around and one side or the other seizes on it. I think the problem they've got two problems here. One is Chris Collins is obviously denying that he did anything wrong. He has not resigned from Congress, although Paul Ryan, the speaker, did remove him from the main committee. He sits on the Energy and Commerce Committee. That's one problem. But the second problem, I think this is dangerous territory for Democrats, because if you really are going to look around at corruption, they've got their fair share of it as well, too. And case number one is Bob Menendez, who's running for re-election in New Jersey for the Senate. And prosecutors did drop charges against him earlier this year, but only because they could not get a unanimous verdict on claims that he had done political favors for a donor and friend in return for gifts and other things. And while they dropped those charges, the Senate did censure him. And they were very tough and said that he had definitely not acted ethically. So they've got a couple of other examples of folks, one who's serving time from the House, a Florida congresswoman for defrauding a charity. So they've got their own group of people that, you know, you can't stand up and say are the finest of souls.
I think the term of art the Senate Ethics Committee used, Dan, severely admonished. But if you read that letter from the Ethics Committee to Senator Menendez, it is none of the facts are in dispute.
No,
he did
rough.
All those things, and I think that he's a very lucky man that the administration didn't take basically rejected his lobbying to change Medicare rules on behalf of his friend, the doctor donor.
Yes, and the voters in New Jersey, at least, are well aware of all this. It was big news in New Jersey. But that raises the question of how big a news do you think Chris Collins is in, say, Iowa? I mean, you know, I'm sitting here thinking we've spent a fair amount of time here the past week, since Tuesday anyway, saying that the Republicans, after the results in Ohio and elsewhere, are almost doomed to lose the House. And you almost got to wonder why. I mean, what are the what are the Democrats doing other than showing up and putting their names on? I mean, Kim is absolutely right. Here's a party scrambling, desperate to figure out something to run on other than Donald Trump. They tried health care, didn't get a rise. And now Chris Collins of upstate New York, who Joe Scarborough on the morning, this morning said, shows Trump is up to his neck in the swamp. Really? It kind of shows how the media swamp is up to its is become so inbred that they think this obscure congressman is going to resonate across the country.
I think Joe Scarborough has that on a repeating loop every show, just talking about anything that happens is the same point. Collins is I read the indictment. It's not good. I mean, I wouldn't want to defend myself against that fact set. Now, insider trading raps are not always successful, and Collins proclaims his innocence, and he'll get his day in court. The difference, I think, one thing, Kim, Democrats are trying to do is reprise their theme from 2006, which was successful, about corruption. That was when Tom DeLay was running the House. You had the Jack Abramoff scandal, which was a legitimate and serious scandal of influence peddling. You had some of the DeLay staff were later indicted. And that was and there were two or three Republicans. I think Duke Cunningham, remember the California fighter pilot who was he went to the pokey. You've got a fair number of there were some real cases. This time, I think much of this is essentially concocted, and there will get some traction because these days, most of the media will amplify whatever theme the Democrats raise. But I don't think this is going to do it for them.
Yeah. Look, I think the reason that theme worked for Democrats in 2006 is because they actually had a point. That was the year that Republicans did get tossed out. And one of the reasons that they did is because they'd been in the majority for more than a decade. They'd become a bit fat and lazy. They'd lost their reformist ambitions. And you had a raft of members that had just decided that they were going to personally enrich themselves from their time in D.C. And so when they made that claim, I think, you know, it resonated with a lot of voters who were getting sick of this culture, and we're seeing it in the headlines a lot every day. This one is a much harder case to make, I think both because there's not a spate of these and because the occasional ones that have come out have been equal on both sides. And, you know, you can't even make a clear-cut argument about Trump and Manafort either, in that, you know, among the things that special counsel Bob Mueller has been looking at are high-ranking Democrats like the Podesta group, which is, you know, potentially in the hot seat for similar accusations that have been made against Manafort and Gates. So they don't have a clear-cut theme in that way, although it has been amusing watching them try. I've been watching a raft of press releases come out from Democratic candidates trying to say, oh, Chris Collins, you know, he had a fundraiser with my opponent 3 years ago, and that just shows how closely connected they are, and my opponent's part of the swamp too. I mean, I don't think that this is going to resonate with people because it's a one-off and a crime as well. That is, it's something that unfortunately we see too often among congressional members, insider trading and you know, financial fraud like crimes. They do pop up with some regularity in insider trading, but it's not something that looks like a giant cabal or that it's widespread across D.C.
Yeah, the Democrats are going to win the House, and I think they're my own view is that the overwhelming favorites to do so now. They're going to have to do it with, number one, they're going to run on anti-Trump enthusiasm. Then they're going to run on, I think, on health care and try to pin rising health care costs on the Republicans. If the Republicans don't fight back, that might possibly stick. And then they're going to run against, basically, on Trump and say, we need a check on Trump. We are the check on Trump. And for some voters, I think that will be the single biggest, single best argument they have.
And the Republicans are going to have to make counter arguments for sure. You know, if nothing else, Tuesday's results were a wake-up call to both professional Republicans and Republican voters. Clearly, there were Republicans in the suburbs of Columbus who decided they could, you know, kind of sit this one out and let Troy Balderson go. By now, they should have some awareness of what the consequences will be, which is to say a Democratic House and maybe a Speaker Pelosi if she isn't overthrown by her own people. But it's, you know, Republicans are staring down the barrel of a big defeat here. And it would be, I have to say, as well, Paul, the president has really expended a lot of political capital on this House race. He's out there putting it on the line. He was in Ohio last weekend. He claims he's going to continue to go out and do these rallies. I mean, the cost in political capital to him, if he does that and loses the House big time, it will be significant. It'll be very tough on his presidency.
All right. We'll leave it at that. Plenty of time in future weeks to talk about the fast approaching midterm elections. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Dan. And we'll be back next week with more editions of Potomac Watch. Meanwhile, you can catch our writing on WSJ.com/opinion.